Can one person single-handedly change his or her nation? If you would have asked somebody that question 200 years ago, specifically Thomas Carlyle, who came up with the great man theory of history, the answer is unreservedly yes. Change in history comes about by heroes or great men, people who have incredible courage, superior intellect, extraordinary leadership abilities, or divine inspiration, who cause systemic change. It's almost like society is a forest, and these great men are the gardeners who bring order to things and choose how things are organized. But for the last 150 years, scholars of the humanities have pushed back against this idea and said that social change also comes about by the accumulation of the acts of less powerful people. A critic of Carlyle, Herbert Spencer, said that so-called great men are merely products of their social environment. So for example, we all remember Hitler, Napoleon, and Alexander the Great for changing society and entire continents in the span of a few short years, but they were also products of societies that were incredibly educated, technologically advanced, and just so happened to have the world's most powerful military at their disposal. They couldn't have done the same thing if they were products of tribal societies and isolated islands, or leading a second or third tier power like the Netherlands or Luxembourg. Today's guest is Sir Ian Kershaw, author of the book Personality and Power, Builders and Destroyers of Modern Europe. We're going to look at a number of 20th century leaders and explore what it was about them that allowed them to have such untrammeled and murderous power, whether they were as unconstrained as they seemed to be, and if so, how they attained that power, what factors brought this era to an end, and the lessons that we can learn as we enter a new age of populist politics. We discuss Vladimir Lenin, Benito Mussolini, Adolf Hitler, and Joseph Stalin, Cold War leaders like Konrad Adenauer, Francisco Franco, and Joseph Tito, and those that saw this era come to an end, including Margaret Thatcher, Mikhail Gorbachev, and Helmut Kohl. For all this, we discuss an important framework about how people obtain power, how it's used, and what the limits are. Hope you enjoyed this discussion with Sir Ian Kershaw. And one more thing before we get started with this episode, a quick break for a word from our sponsors. Your book addresses a question that historians grapple with, and it's not an easy question of how much credit do we have to give to a single particular leader of altering the events of his society, and how much of a say does society have in that? On one end of the spectrum, you'll say that one person directly alters the course of events, and you can see this in the writings of historians 150 years ago, where an Encyclopedia Britannica entry on the Huns would essentially be a biographical description of Attila and nothing else. On the other end, you put so much emphasis on society that you take for granted that there were even war leaders. And you imagine that if there weren't a Napoleon, France would have excreted him out. And he is just simply a natural response to the events of the French Revolution. So to begin broadly, before we get into the particular profiles that are described at length in your book, how far can a single leader alter the course of history?
Well, of course, the answer to the question is obviously that both structural determinants and individual decisions make a big difference to the lives of millions. So if we just for a second imagine that Hitler had never existed, then we can see that things would have been very different for millions of people in Europe and across the globe, actually. I say in the book, no Hitler, no Holocaust. That doesn't mean to say there wouldn't have been any anti-Jewish discrimination in Germany, but it's unlikely that the events in Germany would have led to the Holocaust without this man. So then if we just take those as examples, Hitler or Churchill, or Stalin, then you can see that they did make an enormous difference to history. And yet, of course, the structural determinants that produce these figures are also crucial. And there's no mathematical formula where you can say so many percentage of the individual and so many percentage of structural determinants. So the thrust of the book is that the structural conditions produce particular sorts of leaders who then utilize the conditions to make decisions which are themselves fundamental in shaping history.
In particular, you focus on the 20th century. And what is different about this historical era versus others? Because some of the things that you discuss are timeless, of the amount of impact that a particular leader can have. Yet at the same time, the governmental arrangements are different. Monarchies have mostly lost their power at this time. Monarchs are figureheads, even in the early part of the 20th century compared to other eras. Empires essentially disappear after World War I, or particularly after World War II in the British and the French sense. So what is it about the 20th century that you think is distinct with this period in history and the particular leaders that you profile?
But the 20th century has produced the two world wars, which determined that century and in many ways have determined the world that we live in today. So the two crucial events in the 20th century, two crucial episodes, were the First World War between 1914 and 1918 and the Second World War between 1939 and 1945. And these two episodes shaped history and shaped actually the individuals who came to the fore, who produced the changes, individual changes, which themselves were so fundamental in the writing of the history of the 20th century.
And finally, what would you say it is that the time when they lived in the 20th century that allowed these figures to have such access to untrammeled and murderous power? Is it the abilities of the modern state to give them access to mass communications and technology and machineries of administration that do this, or is it something psychological, some other factor that you would point to?
No, as you say, the developments of the state in the 20th century meant that these individuals, especially dictators, once they acquired power, were able to utilize all the advantages of modern technology, of modern mass communication. So individuals like Mussolini and Hitler, once in power, were able to shape their own individual hold on power through the utilization of modern technology. And so the state, after the First World War, was changing very rapidly. We have revolutionary conditions in numerous countries in Europe, particularly, of course, in Russia. We have the creation of the fascist movements and of communist movements. So democracy is on the back foot across Europe. It's very fragile. It's a new creation. And in these conditions, then, individuals are able to exercise enormous power, greater than even the monarchs of the preceding century. So what you can say is that the First World War in particular produced then enormous structural, fundamental structural crisis in Europe. And the greater the crisis, the greater the possibility for individuals who could use the crisis to gain power, to have the scope to exercise that power with destructive, often catastrophic effect.
This is where I'd like to get into the case studies, because you've elucidated the boundaries very well here, showing that in the face of a significant catastrophe, movements that otherwise, shall we say, shouldn't have succeeded were able to succeed, whereas there were other popular movements that, in a way, their time had come, and it's not as surprising that we would see events like this transpire, such as emancipation of slaves in, let's say, Brazil in the 1880s. It had happened already in so many other nations that it's not a surprise that it took place, whereas it may be much more surprising in the British Empire in the 1830s. Let's look at a particular case of someone at the beginning of the 20th century. And for Vladimir Lenin, this is an example with the Russian Revolution that I've seen a number of historians say that it's only because of the very unique circumstances in the Russian Empire that allowed the Bolshevik Revolution to succeed. So can you talk about his interplay between personality and power?
Yes, Russia was in 1917 absolutely ripe for revolution. There'd been a failed revolution in 1905. In 1917, however, a number of factors came together, which then enabled the conditions which produced revolution in Russia. And what you have there is a complete disenchantment, disillusionment, and outright anger of vast numbers of troops who felt that they'd been betrayed by the Tsarist regime. So those conditions on the front merged together with revolutionary conditions at home within Russia. They produced a revolution in February 1917. Lenin at this stage was still, as he had been for most of his adult life, in exile in Western Europe. Lenin had no possibility of getting back to Russia at that time, having to cross through Germany, which was, of course, at war with Russia, except that the Germans then provided him with him and many of his, and about 30 of his followers, with a sealed train in which they took him from Switzerland to St. Petersburg, where the epicenter of the revolution. Lenin was brought back to St. Petersburg then, and that enabled him, this help that he retained, that he had from the German enemies, enabled him then to be in a position to lead the revolution, lead the second of the revolutions in 1917, the Bolshevik Revolution. Had the Germans not ferried him back to St. Petersburg, he would have been stranded in abroad in exile, a theoretician of revolution, well recognized by many of his who admired him from afar, but not in a position actually to lead the Bolshevik Revolution in October 1917. History would have been very different had that SEAL train not brought Lenin back to Russia. Once there, he, Lenin, then directed that revolution and directed the fate of the Bolsheviks, who were a minority party, and enabled them to take power and to radically to take power, to not just to take power, but to exclude the other parties in revolutionary parties from that power, so that the Bolsheviks were able to gain a monopoly of power within Russia, soon to be the Soviet Union. And that was really the creation of a system that lasted down to 1991.
As I said before, that some would almost say it's a historical accident in a way that the Bolsheviks succeeded. But in the case of Benito Mussolini, I would be very interested to get your analysis of the interplay between the conditions in Italy that enabled his rise and how he personally made it successful. Because I hear a lot of people talk about fascism and the 1920s, 1930s interwar period of Europe that led to a rise of number of populists. And some argue that the conditions now in Europe, the United States, really throughout the world, Brazil, that are enabling the rise of these populist figures mirror those of the 1930s. And Mussolini is interested because he was sort of everyone's favorite fascist before the word fascist became a dirty word. And members of the Roosevelt administration, when they were considering their New Deal reforms, looked favorably upon Mussolini as someone who could unite corporate with state power to effect swift and efficient change in his nation. So please talk about this Mussolini's administration and this interplay between him and the conditions in Italy that made him possible.
Well, the conditions that made Mussolini possible were the conditions of Italy immediately following the First World War. So there was political turmoil in Italy, as in many other countries immediately following the war. Italy had suffered a major defeat in 1917 at the Battle of Caporetto, and this had been a sense of national humiliation in Italy. Mussolini had initially been a socialist and had been the editor of a major socialist newspaper in Italy. In 1915, however, he changed sides from being a supporter of Italy's refraining from joining the war to becoming a major advocate of interventions. In 1915, Italy joined the war. The remainder of the war then was certainly less than successful, including this terrible defeat in 1917. The war ended in what the fascists came to call a mutilated victory. That is to say that Italy didn't have the territorial gains which it had wanted from the war. And Mussolini was able in the immediate post-war period then to gain a following of those people, many of them disenchanted former soldiers, students, people from the lower middle classes and so on, who then joined this nascent fascist movement, one of many originally. And Mussolini, for a time, was only one fascist leader amongst others. But he did have the advantage that because of his media connections, he was able to utilize those to gain prominence within the early fascist movement, which developed a great degree of thuggery, of violence leveled against left-wing opponents of the early fascist movement. And on his way into power by 1922, Mussolini was appointed prime minister of Italy in October 1922, exactly 100 years ago. And on his way to power, was able very cleverly to combine two aspects of his political claims to power. One, for the conservatives, said that he would restore order in the country. It was a very disorderly country at that time. To the radicals within his own movement, he offered further radicalization, a clean sweep of politics, violence, and so on. Once in power in 1922, he was able to utilize his power then to expand that power, in particular after an incident within the party in 1920, a crisis within the party in 1924-5, able to expand his power. So between 1925 and 29, he became the absolutely dominant supreme figure in Italy. One important thing to note, though, is that there was always an alternative form of legitimization for that government, which was the King of Italy. Mussolini never got rid of the monarchy, unlike Germany, where Hitler from 1934 had no other competing source of legitimization. It was an important distinction later on. So Mussolini from 1925 onwards was able to develop absolute power in the country, with the one exception that beyond him remained the monarchy. And in 1943, when Mussolini was toppled, the monarchy then played a significant part in that.
I suppose this is a chance to explore the idea of fascism more clearly, because figures in your book are, there are a number that openly embrace the title. They're not being called that by their opponents, as we see in the 21st century, where the label fascism is thrown around so liberally, it almost just means a political figure I don't like who misuses their political power, which we think of every political figure we don't like as misusing their political power. But you have people like Francisco Franco, Mussolini, and others who openly embrace it. So I suppose to perform a public service and help listeners understand, if they're going to use that term, they should know exactly what it means. What is a fascist, and what made fascist politicians like Hitler or Franco successful? Is it charisma, something else? Can you dive into that concept?
Yes, fascism is notoriously difficult to define, but it means really the sweeping away of the existing systems. So radically anti-democratic, anti-liberal, anti-socialist, anti-communist, and so on, a whole number of antis there, radical sweeping away of the existing political system, and at the same time, the promise of a new start, of a new form of national regeneration, which will bring about a new society altogether. And we can say that all fascists were populists, but not all populists are fascists. And that there is a distinction, therefore, to be drawn between today's populists who exist in a completely different sort of society. They don't start off by saying they want to sweep away the entirety of the system, nor do they utilize the level of violence which was then commonplace in the streets of Italian and then German cities in the way which the then fascists did. So fascism is it's a protean movement which can adapt to many circumstances, but it needs crisis of a political system and a readiness then to destroy the entirety of that system and to rebuild it in the promise of a new society.
Hey everyone, Scott here. We're going to take a short break for a word from our sponsors. That's a good point that you make, that we can't simply conflate populism with fascism and need to have our boundaries clear. Now, we started this conversation mentioning Adolf Hitler, and he's so overused that there's a term called Godwin's Law, that the first person to compare their debate interlocutor to Hitler loses because he's so quickly the go-to comparator. With that in mind, with this idea of the interplay between the man and his moment, so to say, what do you think people misunderstand about Hitler when he's used so often, and him as a case study in your book? What do you think listeners should understand as they're thinking about this interplay between the moment and the particular political figure?
Well, if we just look back again to the First World War, we have to see how fundamental that is to Hitler's chances of getting anywhere near power. Without the First World War, Hitler would have been unheard of in Germany. He was a nobody before the First World War. He then came to local prominence in Bavaria in the immediate years following the war. And he was, in those early years, a political failure. That he, by 1923, he spearheaded an attempt to overthrow the democratic government of Germany and failed, and was then sentenced to a period of time in jail. He was then let out of jail prematurely, well before his sentence was fully served in 1925, was unable then to rebuild the party and to rebuild it in a way which meant that it was now a party that was, the Nazi party, was entirely focused on his leadership. It was a leadership party in a way which no other party had been before in that extreme fashion. But if we then carry on, we see that by 1928, the Nazi Party was still a very tiny fringe party in Germany. 2.6% he got in the general election of 1928. So it was the conditions then of the depression of the early 1930s that projected Hitler into power, that allowed the rise of the Nazi Party. So we have these two things then. The First World War, which produced the preconditions of the crisis which fully emerged in the depression of the early 1930s. And at that time, the Nazi Party went from 2.6% in 1928 to 37.4% in 1932, the largest party in the German parliament. But it's still, we have to bear in mind that in free elections, Hitler never got more than just over a third of the popular vote behind him. So Hitler then came to power in 1933, but because of the crisis in Germany, which was a complete comprehensive crisis of economy, of society, of culture, of politics, of the state, because of that multifaceted comprehensive crisis, Hitler was now able to expand his own power far faster than Mussolini had been able to do in Italy. And within a year and a half, Hitler had attained absolute power within Germany. He had a modern bureaucracy, modern for his time bureaucracy, working to him, a modern army, and so on. And so it wasn't Hitler on his own that we're thinking of, but Hitler did have the power from 1934 onwards to take the crucial decisions, supported by a mass party, a huge party, and supported by large sections now of the German elites and also considerable sections of the population.
Coming to a different figure at these times, Winston Churchill is an interesting example of a person whose career is in some senses made possible by the events of the times. And Churchill has appeared many times on this podcast in the past. And what's interesting is that his political fortunes are in many ways tied to war. He's a wunderkind who becomes Lord of the Admiralty during the First World War, suffers disastrous defeat at the Battle of Gallipoli, is in the political wilderness for nearly a decade, then is prime minister from 1945, promptly loses almost immediately after the war is over, and all returns as prime minister and as a member of parliament up till near his death. The moments of which we best remember him are linked to wartime. So what do you make of this with Churchill's career?
Again, it demonstrates the crucial component of crisis in bringing these people together. Crisis brought Mussolini, Lenin, Mussolini, Hitler, and now Churchill into power. Without crisis, Churchill would have not been Prime Minister of Britain in 1940. So the comprehensive crisis that Britain was facing then, of a completely different kind to that of Germany, was the crisis that it faced invasion from across the English Channel. The German Wehrmacht was marching through Western Europe, and the British troops were stranded in France, and it was thought that none of them would be brought back, so Britain would have lost then over 300,000 troops in practically the entirety of its available army at the time. Churchill came to power, therefore, in the most unpropitious circumstances, and he came to power largely because there was no alternative. He'd been, as you were indicating there, in many ways, a political failure down to 1940. He'd had many of the great offices of state, but he hadn't really been a massive success in any of them. And for the previous years, in the 1930s, he'd been, as he put it himself, in the wilderness. But he'd been, as it turned out then, by 1939, from being seen as someone who was unpopular within his own party, he was now seen as someone who's prophetic, that he'd all the way through been suggesting that the German rearmament was going to create a critical time for Europe, going to be produce war, and that Britain was unprepared for that war. And so from being a voice in the wilderness, as he himself said, Churchill was now seen as prophetic. And in 1940, the two contenders to become prime minister were Lord Halifax, who was a self-effacing individual who did not have the makings of a war leader, and Churchill. Halifax was diffident, didn't really want to be prime minister. Churchill wanted nothing more. So in those circumstances, Churchill, although not the favourite of his own party, not the favourite of the king, was nonetheless made prime minister. And good thing, too, that he was. He was the right man at the right time in the right place. And Churchill then, in those early months of the war, played personally a crucial role initially then in deciding even that Britain would continue in the war and would not, as Lord Halifax himself suggested, make overtures towards looking for a peace settlement with Mussolini and later on, no doubt, with Hitler.
He's an excellent example of someone remembered because he's the right person as a war leader. But as you note in your book, there are also people who, although much less remembered, are the right person to be a peacetime leader. They may not be the commanding charismatic figure to rally a nation during wartime, but they are a highly intelligent, effective administrative mind that knows how to allocate resources, rebuild an economy, have a good tax code. And perhaps nobody better an example of this is Konrad Adenauer, who's the first chancellor of the Republic of Germany when West Germany is fully regaining its independence in the post-war period. And the German economic miracle is perhaps the best example I can think of in the modern period of rebuilding an economy after a war where Germany is under near total devastation and almost less than two decades completely rebuilds its economy, is once again a manufacturing powerhouse in Europe. How is he sort of the right person in this setting, not a wartime leader, but a peacetime leader?
The economic miracle that you just mentioned, we should say at the outset, was insofar as it was instrumentalized in Germany, which benefited from external factors in this, such as the Korean War in particular of the early 1950s. But the key figure there was not Adenauer so much as Ludwig Erhard, his economics minister. But this happened under the aegis of Adenauer as the Chancellor of the Federal Republic of Germany at the time. And Adenauer had much experience, administrative experience, of running the big city of Cologne before the advent of the Nazis in the 1930s. He was then in exile and arrested a couple of times by the Nazis during the Third Reich, but then emerged afterwards in the British zone of northern Germany, then as the key figure in the newly created Christian Democratic Union. And in that, through that basis, he was able then in these conditions where Germany was still not only a united country, of course, part of it was then in the eastern zone under Soviet aegis, but even in western Germany, it was not united, but divided into different zones, the British zone, the American zone, and the French zone. And only gradually was Adenauer able then to play the part in bringing together the conditions of the devastated country through his own tactical acumen, through his administrative ability, and the fact that the Western allies could depend upon him, to able to use his conditions then to cement his own political preeminence and to bring about then the creation of the Federal Republic of Germany in 1949. This was the key step, and thereafter, now presided then through, he was authoritarian instincts, as we said, but he was very able to utilize his own authoritarian tendencies, nonetheless, within a collective form of government to create a group of very key figures around him, very able figures around him, who were able then to put Germany back on its feet, benefit from the economic miracle that you mentioned, and within a remarkable time of just 10 to 15 years, to create a strong economy once more in Germany. And one other thing that one has to emphasize about Adenauer, because in retrospect, we think it's self-explanatory, but it wasn't so self-explanatory at the time, is Adenauer insisted from the beginning upon the binding of West Germany to the Western allies, and in particular to the United States. That was the pivot of his entire policy in West Germany, and that proved to be extremely successful and the key to the German recovery and sustainability of that recovery.
Moving forward in the 20th century, let's look at the example of Margaret Thatcher. Describe the social conditions of the 1980s and what made her such an effective politician at this time, for better or worse, depending on one's politics.
Well, in the 1970s, Britain had been going through a bad time. It's been buffeted by the storm winds that had followed the Arab-Israeli War of 1973 and the energy crisis of that time, which emerged from that war. And Britain was politically unstable. Not the system. The system was stable enough, but the governments were unstable. And neither Conservatives nor the Labour Party were able to provide stable government in the 1970s. And social conditions were also deteriorating. as inflation gathered pace. We're seeing inflation again today. In the 1970s, we had high inflation. At one point, it reached 27% in Britain. And in those conditions, people were looking for strong leadership, which could put the country back on its feet again. And it was that that brought Margaret Thatcher into office as Prime Minister in 1979, initially an unlikely figure to be Prime Minister, a woman in a man's world, and from a provincial background, not from the usual higher upper middle class backgrounds that produced most of the Conservative leadership. So she had a double handicap, but by 1979 was in a position to lead the party, Conservative Party, to a general election victory, a sizable one, and in the 1980s then to preside over governments which were gradually able to bring inflation down over a period of time. It took 3 or 4 years to do that, and there were painful years indeed for the British economy as deindustrialization was carried out at breakneck speed. By 1983, she benefited from the Falklands War, the war in 1982 where Britain fought against Argentina to take back the control over the Falkland Islands in the South Atlantic, and benefited also from the disarray on the political left to extend her hold on British politics and push through major social and economic changes, above all this deindustrialization leading on to privatization of major sectors of the economy, which kept her in power with extended control until 1990. By then, she was losing her touch, and what I call in the book, the arrogance of power, meant that she made a couple of fundamental political mistakes, which resulted in her being evicted from power by her own inner circle, by her own cabinet in November 1990. But she had made a fundamental impact upon the British economy and the British political system by that time.
One type of leader that doesn't get much recognition is one who's able to handle the peaceful dissolution of his empire or state. There are positive examples of Britain granting independence to its colonies, by no means perfect, but we could think of many examples where it was much worse. And Mikhail Gorbachev is an interesting figure who recently passed away. At the time when the Soviet Union fell and broke apart, shortly after he was awarded a Nobel Peace Prize, there was no nuclear war or Armageddon that many feared. But by his countrymen, Russians overwhelmingly did not like him. The perception is that because he didn't handle the dissolution successfully, this is what caused the Russian economic collapse that caused Russia to fall from its perch as one of the great superpowers. And regardless of whether or not the Soviet Union should have subsisted, many, even like Putin, argue that for it to remain in its consistent form into the 20th century is a bit empty-headed. It could have been handled in a way that didn't knock the Russians off their perch on the world stage. So what do you see as Mikhail Gorbachev's success in handling the challenges that he was given? Scott here. One more break for a word from our sponsors.
Gorbachev, his legacy is ambivalent, as you say, that for the Western world, he is this titanic figure who ends the Cold War, reduces nuclear armaments for time, is a figure who offers peace in Europe and is seen, therefore, as a great progressive individual in European politics, ushering in a new era after 1991. For Russian citizens, and Soviet citizens more generally, but for Russians in particular, completely different legacy, one where he is seen to have destroyed their own country. And as an indirect part of that legacy, we have today the figure of Putin, who wants to restore pride to Russia and to rebuild in many ways the destroyed Russian, not Soviet, destroyed Russian empire. So Gorbachev's an ambivalent figure, but I single him out at the very end of the book, say that in the two figures that stand out, I think, for me, are in the terrible first half of the 20th century, probably Hitler. In the second, without doubt, then Gorbachev is the outstanding figure of that time. Now, Gorbachev started off as he was a great admirer of Lenin. He was an apparatchik who came up through within the Soviet system. he wanted to reform that system, not destroy it. But he ended up by doing precisely that, by destroying it. So within 6 years, this figure who'd come to power in March 1985 ended up by destroying the Soviet Union. And in his own personal metamorphosis, he'd gone from being an ardent Leninist to becoming something like a West European social democrat in his approach to politics. So when he came into office in 1985, the Soviet Union was in a bad state, economically in a bad state. It was losing the arms race with the USA, having pouring in vast amounts into armaments. The standard of living for the population was very poor. The economic situation, therefore, was in dire need of reform, and Gorbachev saw that from the beginning, wanted to reform it, but rapidly realized he couldn't reform the economic system without reforming the political system. Now, the political system was in no good shape, it's true, but the experts on the Soviet Union tend to agree that it was not about to collapse in 1985, not about to collapse, could have staggered on for a number of years after that time. Gorbachev himself, through his policies of glasnost and perestroika, of offering open expression of opinion and restructuring, Gorbachev contributed single-handedly then to that process of dissolution, which by 1989 and 1990 was in full swing. And Gorbachev, but only then in 1989 to 90, as the economy was imploding and all sorts of movements for liberation, for independence were extending themselves on the periphery of the Soviet Union, only then did Gorbachev's popularity collapse completely. So he was a remarkable figure who introduced immense change in his own country and throughout the whole of Europe, and brought freedom, of course, to millions of Europeans in Central and Eastern Europe, as well as causing great distress to his own countrymen.
What factors do you think brought this era of Europe that you examined to an end?
Yes, it came. That era came to an end effectively in 1991. And yet we're seeing now in our own days, I think, the end of the period that was introduced at the fall of the Iron Curtain in 1991. So we're now seeing really the start, I think, of a new era again. So we had a 30-year period or thereabouts, which brought us optimism and peace and prosperity. And since 2008, we've seen that world starting to collapse with the finance crash of 2008 and a series of crises since then, which have then resulted, I think, in the end of that era with the invasion of Ukraine by Putin's Russia in February this year.
Well, to give us a sense of our contemporary moment, what you've done is to look at the interplay between political power and personalities who could harness it at a particular time and place with its own unique political and social arrangement that's different from our time. But one of the purpose of studying history, I suppose, in the classical humanities sense, is to understand our place in history and what are common themes that extend across time. So for the listeners I have who live in different constitutional arrangements, whether a parliamentary democracy or a constitutional republic, are Democrats as circumscribed in their power as these constitutional arrangements apply? And what lessons, I suppose, do you hope readers take away from your book as they look at these profiles?
Democrats are, by definition, more circumscribed than our autocrats or dictators, and a good thing too, because it, on the whole, produces better decision-making. Now, that may sound odd when democracy is at present seemingly on the defensive in so many areas, but the constitutional arrangements which have produced democracies and republics in the past two centuries have stood those countries by and large in very good stead, and they have brought more the possibility, it hasn't always worked out that way of course, but it brought the potential for more rational, for more collective and more sensible decision making than you would get with dictators. So one thing that you can say from looking back over the 20th century is that giving power to a single person, especially a person who promises to bring about national salvation and offers what are, on the whole, simplistic answers to very complex problems, that is more than not likely to lead to disaster. And that democracies although the decision-making is slow and ponderous very often, they do produce more rational and more sensible decision-making, which doesn't usually lead to outright catastrophe. So I think that's one thing we can see. And we can see that, of course, that through history tells us where we've got to. It doesn't show us where we're going, but it does nonetheless give us the potential to explore what is then shaping our own world. And with hindsight, the great advantages that historians have, we can, of course, see the rise of Putin and begin to understand much better the ways in which Putin has come to power and expanded that power, and to see that in many ways we have underestimated Putin and underestimated the needs of so many people in Russia to recover from the humiliation they felt at the end of the Cold War. And we can see that path that Putin is taking to expanding his own power in the 22 years or thereabouts that he's been in positions of great power within Russia. So history does show us things. It just shows the dangers of populist leadership in our own times and where that populist leadership might take us to if it is allowed to unfold completely.
These questions of what brings strong personalities of power and what promotes or limits your use of power are timeless, but some of the most important questions as we think about contemporary politics. Well, there are other personalities we couldn't get to. And for listeners who want to explore these biographical profiles and these questions we discuss in much greater detail, the name of Sir Kershaw's book is Personality and Power, Builders and Destroyers of Modern Europe. Sir Kershaw, thank you for joining us.
Great pleasure. Thank you very much indeed. Bye-bye.
All right, that is it for today. If you would like to see show notes for this episode, along with all my others, go to ParthenonPodcast.com. That's the name of the podcast network that I'm a part of, along with James Early's Key Battles of American History, Steve Guerra's Beyond the Big Screen and History of the Papacy, and other great history shows as well. If you'd like to support History Unplugged, the two easiest ways to do so are to subscribe to the show on the podcast player of your choice and leave a review. The second way is to join our membership program, and if you do so, you'll get completely ad-free episodes of the entire back catalog, which is 600 episodes and growing. Just go to patreon.com/unplugged. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.